This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 37. Panchans, there's nothing in the world. A pointer. It's futile effort to linger in thought over the action of a lightning bolt. When the sound of thunder fills the sky, you'll hardly have time to cover your ears. To unfurl the red flag of victory over your head, whirl the twin swords behind your ears. If not for a discriminating eye and a familiar hand, how could anyone succeed? Some people lower their heads and linger in thought, trying to figure it out with their intellect. They hardly realize that they're seeing ghosts without number in front of their skulls. Now tell me, without falling into intellect, without being caught up in gain or loss, when suddenly there's such a demonstration to awaken you, how will you reply? To test, I cite this old case. The main case. Master Panchan imparted these words. There's nothing in the triple world. Where can mind be found? The verse. There's nothing in the triple world. Where can mind be found? The white clouds form a canopy. The flowing spring makes a lute. One tune, two tunes, no one understands. When the rain is past, the autumn water is deep in the evening pond. So this weekend we've been introducing, to those of you here for the weekend, the teachings and practices of the Buddhist and the Zen Buddhist tradition. So the koan is one of many forms of meditation used in Buddhism. There's breath practice, there's focusing on a number of different objects that were laid out by the Buddha and by subsequent masters to develop concentration and study phenomena. There are visualization practices. There's the practice of just mind. There's the practice of the koan, in which the student takes up a question, a sutra, a statement by a teacher, a situation, but takes it up in a new way, in a way that is ultimately not just merging the conceptual and non-conceptual mind, but showing their non-duality. And as with all of these practices, they are developing tranquility, serenity, stability, mindfulness, concentration, samadhi, and that they're also bringing forth insight, helping us to see directly into the nature of things. Because the fundamental nature of things can't be seen, because that's its nature. It has no quality. It has no characteristics. That's our basic nature. How can we study it? How can we realize it? And so we have to turn towards phenomena, the breath, a koan, a visualization, awareness itself, in order to see into that fundamental reality. But in order to do that, at some point, the awareness has to depart or leap free from everything. In other words, we have to begin using our senses in Zazen to ultimately leap beyond the senses. And so here, Panchan, this master, he was a successor of Matsu. So this is 8th, very early 9th century China. And the full teaching that he imparted from the records say, there's nothing in the triple world, where can mind be found? The foundation of the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, is empty. So where does Buddha abide? The firmament, the real nature of mind, is unmoving. It's still and without words. If you come face to face with it, there's nothing left to do. Take care. Here, in the koan, just these first two lines have been taken up. There is nothing in the triple world. Where can mind be found? So what is mind in Buddhism? We are introduced to the sense of attention in Zazen, which is where you bring your attention, you focus your mind. So we put our attention in the breath. There's awareness, right? Knowing that your mind is in the breath. And there is consciousness, which is the whole. It's everything coming together to result in a moment of knowing, a perception of self-awareness. And all of these are mind, but mind is not any of these things. We know distracted mind. Through sitting, we develop mindfulness. Our mindfulness develops and deepens into concentration, a concentrated mind, and ultimately leads to an awakened mind. There's the mind of sentient beings. There's Buddha mind. There's the mind of insentient beings, the mind of mountains and rivers, wind, rain, snow. There's the mind of self and other. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha said, this past mind can't be found. A present mind can't be found, and a future mind can't be found. With which mind do you hear these words? Why is this important? Why in our tradition is this really the fundamental matter? Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva of compassion, realizes mind, realizes all beings are of one essence. Essence here does not mean essence as in a soul, as in something that is permanent and abiding. All beings have one self-nature. An old master said, the sensory world of forms and sounds and tastes, smells and touch, all of this is determined by mind. All of this is mind. Realize that this world we perceive through the senses depends upon mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. If we're going to examine the question or the subject of suffering, of human suffering, what we're really talking about is the subject of our experience as human beings. And that experience that we experience as suffering. So we're really talking about our perceptions through our body, through our sense organs, in our mind of suffering, which means we're really looking at how are we perceiving the world that through these senses within this consciousness leads to suffering. And so no matter how we look at it, we come back to mind. From the point of view of samsara, the suffering is caused by everything that's happening out there. And the Buddha's enlightenment was that there is nothing out there that is not mind. I'm speaking. This is mind. You're listening. This is mind. There is no perception, no contact, no joy, no sorrow, no today, no tomorrow, no suffering or no liberation from suffering that is separate from mind. And yet, it cannot be found. This mind. It cannot be touched or held or preserved or turned into a formula. It cannot be given. It cannot be taken away. It can only be realized directly. That's why we're sitting. To sit in a hall of Buddhas is to sit in a hall of training, is to sit in a hall of meditation, is to sit in a hall of examining mind. Another master said, the coming together of our conceptual categories, all the ways we divide and categorize the world, and our latent karmic tendencies, constructs our perceptions of an autonomous world. In reality, the world is completely dependent on the mind and can be perceived and understood only through mind. No material world exists apart from mind. How do we know there's a world? How do you know you're in this room? How do you know it's snowing? How do you know you're you? Mind, perceptions, sensations, experiences. And this is true also for animals, insects, birds, worms, fish. It's also true for trees and stones, mountains and rivers. Nothing exists apart from mind. Nothing exists within its world separate from mind. Nothing can be in relationship to anything else separate from mind. So when the mind is distracted, you know, which is, as I said on Friday night, is not a neutral state. It's a very active state, our distraction. Even if it's just, you know, sort of inane blather, nothing, you know, that even makes sense. It's a very active state. It's a karmic state. It is a state that leads to results, has consequences, sometimes very serious consequences. And it is conditioning our mind. It is training us. You know, we think of that training the mind begins when you start doing Zazen because it's intentional. I'm meditating. But in a sense, we could say our mind has been in mind training from the beginning. We just haven't thought about it much or been aware of it. So distractedness is a training of the mind to be distracted. And that, this teacher is saying, constructs through our perceptions and the meaning that we give to them, the idea, which is really is our experience, that the world is autonomous. Everything exists in its own orbit, has its own power, comes and goes on its own. That we mingle with each other, right? So during this weekend, those of you who have come, we've sort of, our universes have merged a little bit. We've, you know, cohabitated. We've, you know, affected each other. And we've seen that in, you know, some obvious and perhaps subtle ways. But then you'll leave. And that will end. It's over. Right, so it happens by proximity. The closer you get, the greater the influence. The greater the distance, the lesser the influence, the less the connection, which is, of course, what allows every form of suffering that we exact upon another person to happen, is distance. I was remembering, just came to mind, a student many years ago who was a career officer, and he was telling me about being in the first Iraq War. And that he was in the desert and they had just captured some Iraqi soldiers who were, you know, on the ground. And because of what they had been told about Americans, they just assumed they were going to be shot, just as a matter of course. And so they were begging for their lives. And of course, they were not going to be shot, but they were afraid they were. And one of them took out his wallet and gave it to this man who was to become a Zen student. And in part because of this very moment, he gave him his wallet, and in it there was a picture of his family. And he looked at the picture and he realized, that's my family. He has a wife, I have a wife, he has children, I have children. What am I doing? What are we doing? He said, in that moment, the war for him was ruined, or saved, maybe. And so distance, our distance-making mind, is, which is a distracted mind, is very dangerous. But why does that autonomous world necessarily lead to so much pain and suffering? An old master said, the workings of mind are determined by the circulation of energy, karmic energy, mental, physical, emotional. Mind is without any substance of its own. It cannot be found. The workings of karmic energy. So every thought, every emotion, every decision, every sensation, every reaction we can think of is just a dynamic display of energy that's moving in accord with past actions, desires, consequences, influences from the world around us, moving in a certain way. But the base of that, the root of that, mind, that which it all depends upon, cannot be found. The three worlds is a Buddhist teaching about, it can be understood in certain ways. So one is its form and formlessness and desire. And so the desire realm you could think of as the world of pure samsara, where we're just caught in kind of running, you know, on what we want, what we need, what we don't want, what we don't need, you know, constantly trying to sort of control the world to fulfill our desires. The formless realm you could think of as a little bit more evolved, We've begun examining, we've begun seeing into things, we're less attached, we're less driven by those desires, less in control. There's a lightness of being that's beginning to come forth, a joy, compassion. And the formless realm is where that goes even further, and we realize there is nothing in the triple world. We could also look at that, at how that evolves in our Zazen. And so that desire to control the world, Shantideva said, it's like the world is filled with thorns and brambles and hard rocks, and you're barefoot. And so we try and cover the world with leather, so wherever we walk, our feet are protected. He says it's much easier, just cover your feet with leather. He said, in the same way, it's not possible to control all of our external events, but if I examine and realize the nature of mind, what need is there to control everything? And this is true. This is what we realize. This is what the Buddha was enlightened to. And if we misunderstand this, that we need only master the mind and then everything will be okay. Or just that if I realize mind and I am enlightened, then even though the world is okay, it is not okay, that's okay. It's like I've covered myself in leather. And that's why because these teachings are so powerful, we have to really examine them and understand them carefully. Because otherwise, they can actually hurt us. And so to really understand, you know, every tradition, every spiritual tradition has to deal with the fact of this worldly reality, right, which on some level is understood to be difficult, and whatever the ultimate reality, the sort of the fulfillment that religion or spiritual tradition holds up is possible. So now we have two worlds. We have heaven and we have hell. We have the sacred and we have mundane. We have samsara and we have nirvana. And so the path in each of those traditions is from the world of suffering to the world of heaven or nirvana or freedom from suffering. And so that can have the effect in Buddhism, let's say, because that's where we're at right now, is that it devalues this world. So samsara basically sucks, ditch it, right? And get the address for nirvana and get there and stay there. And forget about samsara. Forget about this place, right? Because we're going to a better place. It's a far, far better thing I do now than I have ever done before. It is a far, far better place that I go to than I have ever been before. Those final lines of the Tale of Two Cities sort of encapsulates that sense that I want to get to that better place. And the moment I set out on that path, this place becomes less important because I'm heading there. I'm out of here, baby. I'm going. Right? So why should I invest in this? That's not... And there are many ways in which we can read into Buddhist teaching and see that as being what the teaching is. And there are many ways in which over the centuries it has been that, for practitioners, for teachers, for communities, for various reasons, and to more or less degree. The Dharma is this life, this place, this time, this person. Trungpa Rinpoche said, it's like falling out of an airplane. The bad news is you got no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. Samsara is the airplane. Samsara is stay away from that door. And so we can base our whole life on that. Don't go anywhere near that door. Samsara can also be throw yourself out of the airplane again and again and again. Samsara can be pretending there's a parachute when there's not. It can be pretending there's a ground when there's not. I'm reading a book by David Loy called Eco Dharma, and that's quite good. And he quotes Bhikkhu Bodhi, who says, despite certain differences, it seems that all forms of classical Buddhism locate the final goal of compassion and action in a transcendent dimension that lies beyond the flux and turmoil of this phenomenal world. Basically what I've just said. For the Mahayana tradition, as opposed to the earlier tradition, that transcendent is not absolutely other than this phenomenal world. Samsara and nirvana are one reality. That's Mahayana teaching, understanding, practice, realization. However, just about all of classical formulations of the Mahayana begin with a devaluation of phenomenal reality in favor of a transcendent state in which spiritual endeavor culminates. The very fact that we come to a monastery can create or reinforce that idea. I have to get away from the phenomenal. Of course, this is pretty phenomenal. In a not phenomenal as in spectacular, but in the sense of being the world. And he goes on to say, it's for this reason that classical Buddhism confers an essentially instrumental value on socially beneficent activity. An instrumental value. It has a purpose. What is that purpose? He says such activity can be seen as a contributing cause for the attainment of nirvana or the realization of Buddhahood. It can help you do that. It can be valued because it helps create better conditions for your moral and meditative life. And so in the early teachings of the Buddha, oftentimes he spoke about that. It's important to live a moral life because if you don't, it makes your mind crazy. That's going to affect your meditation. That's not going to help you in your own liberation. So it again refers it back to oneself. He says it can help lead others to the Dharma, but ultimate value, the overriding good, is located in the sphere of transcendent realization. The primary place belongs to the inner discipline of meditation through which the ultimate good is achieved, liberation. And this discipline, to be effective, normally requires a high degree of social disengagement. Right? We come to a monastery, we sit on our cushion in silence and stillness, we do sesshin. Right? And that's true. I mean, to more or less degree, that in order to develop a practice, we have to actually practice. And that means practicing in every moment, in everything, in every situation, but it does mean based in a meditative life, practicing zazen. Because that is the path that has been tried and found to be most effective to help us to stop and see, to interrupt those karmic inclinations, to see through, to quiet our distractedness and see into the nature of things so that we can actually and genuinely practice every moment. And so what he's saying is true. It's built into this. And so there's a tension, is really what he's saying. There's a tension between that turning in. So for a while, we disengage. We go into silence. But it's not, if we see it as disengagement, then it can become disengagement in our mind, and then it becomes two worlds. And those two worlds will inevitably come into conflict with each other. And the conflict is in the mind. And so part of our training is to see that when we're in silence, when we're doing zazen, when we're in sesshin, when you're at home and you go into a room to meditate, that you're not leaving anything behind. And at the same time, at that moment, we're not in conversation, we're not attending to other things, we're attending to this thing. And so how do we do that without creating distance, without creating, valuing one over the other? How do we see it as one unified world and practice? Joanna Macy talks about spiritual traps. She's a Buddhist teacher, environmentalist. She says one trap is that this phenomenal world is an illusion. Right? And there's many, many, many teachings that use that exact language. It's illusory. But it's like a magician, which is often used as an example of this illusory world. The magician is just using real stuff, their hands, a hat, a rabbit, a box, flowers. Those things all actually exist in time and space. But they're using them in a way to get us to see what they want to see and not see what they don't want us to see. And that's the fun of it, right? Is they're tricking our mind in a way that is entertaining. And that's a metaphor for what delusion does, except that it's not always so fun. Right? The delusion is sort of the inner magician that is tricking our mind to not see what's in front of us. Right? To not see what we need to see, but in a sense we don't want to. But not that it's not real. And so she says, impermanence and made of matter, this illusory world, it's less worthy than the realm of the pure spirit or the transcendent world. Its pain and its demands on us are less real than the pleasures or tranquility we find in transcending them. And this, again, is a kind of built-in tension, because when we practice, if you're in an afflicted state of mind, you're upset, you're angry, you're sad, and you practice that and you're able to really release that, then it does benefit us. It is good. But what she's saying is that then we can begin to devalue or deny or avoid those difficult things because we want that good feeling. Right? That's why insight, that's why just calming the mind and just having tranquility within Zazen or Samadhi is not in and of itself liberation. Because we haven't really seen through the illusion, which is the false view. She says another trap is that suffering, we see suffering as a mistake. It's something that's wrong. It's like an error, a sin. The pain we may feel in beholding the world derives from our own cravings and attachments, mind. According to this view, freedom from suffering is attained by non-attachment to the fate of all beings rather than non-attachment to matters of the ego. I mean, there are many teachings that say have as few relations as possible, relationships, because relationships are fraught, right? And so this is a very dangerous teaching, right? Because it basically sounds like it's, you know, just sort of walk away, find your own peace, find your own liberation. She says another trap is that we create our world unilaterally by the power of our mind, like a fundamental idealist perspective. Our subjective thoughts dictate the form things will take. This is a misunderstanding of mind is the basis of all things. Grief for the plight of the world is negative thinking. Confronting injustice and dangers simply creates more conflict and suffering. It agitates the mind, so don't confront those things that will disturb your mind. These are not things that Buddhism, that we should be doing. She's just as a reminder, these are traps, right? And the corollary, she says, that the world is already perfect when we view it from that transcendent view. We feel then so peaceful that the world will become peaceful without our need to act. But the thing is, it's not a feeling. It may feel peaceful, but what we're striving for is not a feeling that things are peaceful, but to realize the inherent peacefulness of everything. And this is a very difficult thing to understand. How can there be peace within destruction? How can things in a state of, you know, turmoil or, you know, a brokenness, how can each and everything be in and of itself in a state of peace? Logically, that doesn't make sense, and for good reason. When we experience it directly, then we understand. And that peace does not mean do not act. It doesn't mean do not address the injustice. It doesn't mean do not be complacent to our climate crisis. But it does mean understand the basis, the basic nature. So as we are trying to be effective, we're actually effective. How do we practice the suffering in our lives, the daily trials, small and large, the trials of our community and our nation and our world? The immediate pain that we feel when we encounter the suffering of our earth, the suffering of Black Lives Matter, of Me Too, of a president who is not well in a most profound way and is having profound effect. The suffering that we feel, the grief, it means you're alive. Congratulations. What we do with it in that next moment determines whether we create suffering and become paralyzed, cynical, distant, or whether we become effective, constructive, skillful, engaged. And that's the essence of practice. You know, relieving the mind from suffering shouldn't be an anesthetic. It shouldn't be making us numb. We come into practice kind of numb, right? Because when we don't have any other tools, numbness looks pretty good in the presence of suffering, in the presence of a world that is tilting. It helps. It seems to help to just go dead a little bit or a lot. But relieving the mind of suffering actually means waking up, which means it's going to hurt a whole lot. It's a little bit like surgery without anesthesia. You're going to feel this. You know, it's like when the doctor says, you may feel a little sting here. You're going to feel a lot of sting here. And so we have to develop stamina and resilience. And how do we hold this? And how do we understand this? And how do we let go of clinging to this? And practice, and then we develop our skills. And the deeper we go, the more we see what Panchan is saying. In the triple world, there is not a single thing. And in that, everything is present. Awakening the heart, nothing is forsaken. But as he says in the pointer, trying to figure this out, you know, it's futile effort to linger in thought over the action of a lightning bolt. It's done. It's past. When the sound of thunder fills the sky, you'll hardly have time to cover your ears. How do we meet the moment in the moment when it's occurring? And so he says, to unfurl the red flag of victory, in other words, to actually find our way, to actually find our peace, whirl the twin swords behind your ears. The twin swords are heaven and hell, samsara and nirvana, good and evil. Whirl them behind your head and make them one. Realize them as one. Because there is nothing in the triple world, in this universe, there is nothing to grasp, nothing to attach to, nothing to reject, nothing to deny. And doing any of those things, all of those things, will always cause distress. We think that they're protecting us, but they actually cause more distress, which is really just a sign that we are out of alignment. We are not in accord with how things are actually working. Because there is no abiding self, because there is no eternal essence, no permanence, we are freed. We are not bound by identity or the past or fear or insecurity or our goals or failure or success. There are many moments where we will feel bound. There are many moments where we will feel trapped in our mind, trapped by thoughts, trapped by strong emotions, trapped by a situation. And that experience of being trapped is just our perception that is limited, in a sense, by our capacity to see more clearly into that and to live more clearly into it. And that's what keeps changing, what keeps expanding with practice. Because there is no parachute, there's no point in struggling as you fall. I mean, you know, it's like grabbing at the air, right? That doesn't help. It doesn't slow you down. But you don't need to slow down because there's no ground. Because there's no parachute, we do find our peace through, or rather, we cannot find our peace through attachment to money and power and identity, the parachutes that we use to keep us from falling. But what Trungpa Rinpoche is saying is that life is a state of falling. You don't get to choose whether you fall or not. Falling is life. Falling is moving through space where all things are in a state of becoming. Nothing is fixed. Because there's no ground, we can live in this world of money and power and identities, and with practice and every step become more and more free. in this book by Loy, he brings a passage from David Foster Wallace's commencement speech at Kenyon College some years ago. And he quotes him, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice you get is what do you worship? And an outstanding reason for choosing some kind of God or practice or path to worship or follow or practice is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. You'll never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally put you in the ground. Worship power, and you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need even more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid and a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and on and on and on," he says. The Buddha said the very same thing. He said, we can take refuge, try and find our path in all kinds of things. He names very different things, but it's the same point. Foster Wallace goes on to say, look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is that they themselves are not evil or sinful. Money, power, beauty, intellect. These are just realities that exist in a human-created world. He says, what is harmful is that they're unconscious. We don't recognize what we worship. We don't understand what's skillful and not skillful. We don't know, is this a real path, a viable path? He says, they're just default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what we're doing, which is really the design of delusion. Delusion, I mean, it's not like it's being designed by something out there. It's our mind. But the purpose of it is to, in a sense, make everything so easy that it becomes automatic. You don't have to think. I mean, it's why it's so easy to seduce people with slogans. Make America great again. Who doesn't want to do that? Sounds great, right? Just don't examine it. Just don't think about it. Wear it on your hat. That's enough. Holler at the appropriate moment. That's enough. Show your spirit. But don't think. Don't have your own mind. That's like delusion. And that's why it's so hard to see ourselves. Because in a sense, our consciousness has developed this ease with which we interact with the world, we perceive, and it's just become the habit. And it's not a sin. It's not a crime. It's not something wrong. Right? It's just the function. That's why everyone is deluded. It just doesn't work so well. That's the thing. He says, and the world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely for some. For those with money and power, for those who design the humming, will hum along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of the self. Loy says, I don't know if Wallace is a Buddhist. I think there's a pretty good chance. Although, not necessary. Anyone who really examines things will find the Buddhist teachings understandable because they're just about this world. So how do we move into the world? How are we moving in this world? Because we are moving into it already. I was reading about this movement of strikes, these students who are striking in South America and Europe, across Europe and Asia, different countries in Asia, all begun with this 16-year-old young woman, Greta Thunberg from Sweden, who started this protest. She sat outside the Swedish parliament and accused lawmakers of failing to uphold their commitments to fight the climate crisis. And then she met with the economic powers at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland recently, and she spoke. And she said, I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to be afraid. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day, and I want you to act. And so she's inspired students striking from school to bring about just that very change, that action. And on March 15th, there's a big strike happening. It's incredible. And there was a story about an Australian education minister who threatened to punish the students if they strike on the 15th. And she, Thunberg, twittered back and said, okay, we hear you, and we don't care. She said, your statement belongs in a museum. That way of thinking belongs in a museum. It is not a thought for today. It is not a thought for tomorrow. And that's the mind of a bodhisattva. That's the mind, Buddhist or not, of someone who is awake and is engaging. And so it's really important as Buddhist practitioners that we study and examine and really understand these teachings. You know, anything that's power, anything that has power can be dangerous if it's not used well. And there are lots of reasons why, you know, these teachers are talking about how these teachings can be misunderstood, have been misunderstood, and how in many ways that the sort of that full fruition of, you know, saving all sentient beings, you know, has been, you know, part of the Buddhist tradition in certain ways since from the beginning, but reserved, I would say, in most ways. And I think in our time, you know, maybe because our world has gotten so big and so small, maybe because our reach is so broad, maybe because the power of our mind and our intellect and our technology is so far ahead of our spiritual development to actually wield well that which we have created, that the urgency of us as practitioners to maintain the power of that solitary practice. We do need this. Otherwise, we will just bring our confusion and our fear and into the mess, and it gets messier. But we also need to not let that become an anesthetic, something that actually creates distance rather than union, that creates vitality and vibrancy rather than passiveness. And that tension is very alive. How do we maintain that attention? That tension. That attention. So, that's our charge. So I encourage all of you who've been here for the weekend, and some of you are well on your way in talking with you. Some of you are finding your way, discovering what your way is. I think what's important is really something that was important to the Buddha, right? He encouraged his students to practice the Dharma he was teaching, but he really encouraged people to live good lives and to have a way to do that, whatever their path might be. And I think that is our calling, our global, collective, human calling today. That is the time that we're in, is to have a path. Because as Wallace is saying, we have one. Is it a true one? We are worshiping something. Is what we worship worthy of our reverence? So may we all take care of it. And that means every day, thought, words, and actions, intentions, practice, falling.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.